from WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Congress and the White House clashed over President Bush's proposed $3.1 trillion budget for 2009. Most of the anger was aimed at its call for tax cuts. But for us freedom of information wonks, there was something else tucked into Bush's budget: the elimination of the new job of FOIA ombudsman. When citizens try to obtain government documents under the Freedom of Information Act, the ombudsman was created to consider their cases fairly when their requests were denied. The position was written into the Bipartisan Open Government Act, signed into law on New Year's Eve when champagne corks were popped. But now it's all gone flat because Bush's budget effectively killed the ombudsman. Rebecca Carr is national correspondent for Cox Newspapers. She says the ombudsman could have helped make the system more responsive to the public it's supposed to serve.
There's some Freedom of Information requests languishing in excess of 15 years. That's far in excess of the 20-day time limit. And this is the first time in 10 years that any legislation has passed Congress that addresses the major problems within the Freedom of Information Act.
Assuming it isn't defanged in the budget process, how does it affect the work of journalists? I mean, if there really were, for instance, a 20-day response deadline to FOIA requests, could that usher in a new era of aggressive watchdogging?
Well, that is certainly the hope of journalists in Washington and throughout the country, that if the Freedom of Information Act actually works, you are going to see, you know, not just a spring of information, but a river.
FOIA has been ailing for a while. Why did Congress pass this act now?
What really was the impetus behind this was a Republican by the name of John Cornyn of Texas, who rode to town saying he was going to be the open government master. And he worked hand in hand with Patrick Leahy of Vermont, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, to bring about this change. It wasn't easy. It took over 5 years to make what some consider very small changes, but in essence, changes that would make the Freedom of Information Act more accessible to the average citizen out there.
So summarize some of these small changes that the Open Government Act would make in the process.
They were going to have a federal tracking system for Freedom of Information Act requests. There were going to be penalties levied for agencies that failed to comply within a 20-day time period. And they were going to, for the first time, allow people who actually had to go to court to pry loose documents, those individuals would be reimbursed for their legal fees. But the centerpiece is the ombudsman. The ombudsman was seen as an independent arbitrator of Freedom of Information Act disputes. Right now, it's so difficult to get information from the government that many requesters who are filing Freedom of Information Act requests are forced to go straight to court after the 20-day time limit. So the ombudsman was going to step in and say, hey, I'm the independent guy. I'm going to see if the federal agencies are accurate in withholding this. And it was going to prevent parties from having to go to court.
The president signed this act and this position into law, right?
That's right. Senator Leahy and Senator Cornyn have been trying to pass this legislation for 5 years. Finally, in December, the Senate passes this their bill by unanimous consent. That's huge. It goes over to the House 1 week later. It passes by voice vote. So in essence, you have legislation passing unanimously in Congress, which is, as you know, a very rare thing.
It's veto-proof.
It's veto-proof. It goes to the president's desk. The president sits on it. And finally, on New Year's Eve, he quietly signs this legislation into law on his Texas ranch. And the open government community is ecstatic. But then, in the dark of night, you could say, because buried in the president's mammoth, inches-thick budget document, on page 239 of the appendices of the Commerce Department section, which had nothing to do with the Justice Department, is a phrase that does not mention FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, does not mention the Office of Government Information Services, which is the name of the ombudsman, does not mention the National Archive. It just has this, you know, pithy little phrase that says this position will no longer exist and all duties are transferred to the Justice Department. What makes this so egregious is the Justice Department is the very agency that's been criticized for not enforcing the Freedom of Information Act in the position of settling conflicts. So it's not just the open government advocacy groups that are upset. Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, are very upset because it's basically taking Congress's law and thumbing their nose at it.
Is Congress so mad that it will therefore not approve Bush's budget?
They're not likely to stop a $3.1 trillion train car in order to restore an ombudsman office at the National Archives at a time when we're at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, at a time when we have a hotly contested political election going on. It's probably, this is going to fly right under the radar. You might ask, what options are left? Cornyn and Leahy are already working behind the scenes to publicly advocate to restore the ombudsman role. This week, they sent a letter to OMB Director Jim Nussle, urging him to restore this, expressing their displeasure. In addition, Cornyn and Leahy could offer an amendment on the floor when the budget resolution comes to the floor that would strip the language from the president's proposal. So there are some legislative options here. All is not lost.
Rebecca, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Rebecca Carr is the national correspondent for Cox Newspapers.
The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board was formed in the spring of 2006, one of many recommendations by the 9/11 Commission. Despite calls for an independent body, the Republican Congress placed the board in the executive office of the president, meaning the board would be appointed by Bush and serve at his pleasure. This was, however, no pleasure at all to civil liberties advocates. Lisa Graves is deputy director of the Center for National Security Studies, and she believes the board's second annual report, published a little more than a week ago, is less a check on government power than a rubber stamp. It's no surprise, she says, given some of the board's members.
To paraphrase Justice Scalia, five people picked at random out of any phone book would have done a better job in protecting civil liberties. The chairperson of the board, Carol Dinkins, is a longtime friend of the Bushes. She was a Bush appointee in Texas. She was in the Reagan administration. She was also in the ABA and was the person who helped shepherd through the high ratings of Bush's controversial judicial nominees in the first term of this president.
The ABA, the American Bar Association.
Yes, so she is a known partisan.
And former Solicitor General Ted Olson.
Mr. Olson obviously was instrumental in Bush v. Gore, later served as the Solicitor General of the United States in the Bush Justice Department. Overall, he is known as a defender of the president. Mr. Alan Rowell, who is a respected lawyer in Washington, D.C., is also someone who served in the Reagan administration in the Associate White House Counsel's Office during Iran-Contra. And while he has a private practice involving giving advice to digital companies about privacy and technology matters, he certainly doesn't have a record of being a civil libertarian.
So these very vigilant watchdogs convened and held exactly one public meeting in December of 2006. What happened there?
At that meeting, I asked the board to share with the American people the number of Americans who'd been subject to the warrantless wiretapping that the board had given its blessing to. They refused. And they refused to let the press ask any questions at this only public meeting.
Now, shortly after that nominally public meeting, the board issued its first of two annual reports. Can you tell me what kind of oversight the Oversight Board evinced in those reports?
I would say that they evinced a hand-in-glove relationship with the White House. The first report indicated the board's favorable disposition toward the warrantless wiretapping of the president that is plainly in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And they basically took the White House line almost throughout the entire document in terms of saying any controversial policy had sufficient internal controls and people shouldn't be worried about their civil liberties or privacy.
Now, in fairness, we should note that the board has raised a couple of issues with the way the administration has gone about its business, one involving the national security letters, which permit federal authorities to do warrantless searches.
You're right, but I would say that the criticism was mild. And in fact, in the case of the national security letters, which have been extremely controversial because they allow the FBI to access any American's financial records, phone records, or internet records without any court oversight, there was an inspector general audit that was ordered by Congress that revealed widespread misuse and abuse of national security letters. And so the FBI admitted that it had made severe mistakes. In this final report of the board criticizes the FBI for making those mistakes, but then provides a roadmap to the FBI for how to do a better PR job in defending national security letters, which is really a bit astonishing.
Now, in the category of good news, bad news jokes, I guess the good news is that this toothless oversight board is no longer functioning. And the bad news is that this oversight board is no longer functioning. The original five members saw their terms expire in January, and they have not been replaced.
That's right. Actually, one of the board members, the only Democrat on the five-person board, resigned in the midst of the first report because the first report was heavily edited by the White House. So for the bulk of last year, there were only four members, all of whom have records of service in the Bush administration or the prior Bush administration. And that board ceased to exist this January because Congress, under Democratic control, decided to take the board out of the executive office of the White House, where it never should have been, and have it be an independent executive branch agency. Knowing that that was coming, the White House did not act quickly and hasn't submitted any nominations. I think this White House has very little interest in having a board that has any independence. Although, at the end of the day, a board is no substitute for an aggressive and informed, vigorous oversight process by Congress, in which Congress is not intimidated by the word terrorism, where Congress is an equal player in our political system and demands that the law and the rule of law be followed.
All right, Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Lisa Graves is Deputy Director of the Center for National Security Studies.
Coming up, self-censorship in Kenya and the corporate email that got away.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In late December, charges of voter fraud in Kenya's national elections sparked riots across the country. As the violence escalated, Kenya's newly reinstated government imposed a ban on all live radio and TV broadcasts, quote, in the interest of public safety and tranquility. Some broadcasters stopped reporting on the conflict altogether. As human rights were brutally violated, music and comedy filled the nation's airwaves. On Monday, Kenya's National Dialogue and Reconciliation Team pledged to lift the ban amid pressure from press freedom groups and the Kenya Editors Guild. In theory, Kenyan journalists could have reported whatever they wanted all along as that reporting wasn't live. But Ida Yuste of the media advocacy group Internews says that the seemingly mild press restriction triggered a rash of confusion and self-censorship, especially among Kenya's fledgling vernacular press.
Well, first of all, the irony is that very few of the broadcasters actually have the technology to effect any kind of delay whatsoever. So even if they did want to implement it, they couldn't. You should also realize that there's been an absolute explosion of FM radio stations in Kenya. Many of those staffed by junior people, people who had never, ever even covered any kind of international story. So I guess some of them were simply scared. And then there is also the fact that two of the main media houses in Kenya have behind them, when it gets to ownership, sizable political muscle. So at that point, editors just weren't bold enough to withstand the pressure from a government-imposed ban. In time, media houses and, in fact, the Editors Guild and, of course, journalists started responding more appropriately.
What was the state of the press in Kenya before the disputed election results?
It had been making great strides. Increasingly robust behavior started to emerge from newsrooms all over Kenya, and it has been getting better and better. So it's particularly sad that this ban took journalism in Kenya back some 5 to 10 years.
Were there any threats? Was anyone imprisoned as a result of the reporting?
No one has been imprisoned, but the threats relate more to the fact that there is a huge schism within Kenyan society and that journalists, sometimes by simply telling the truth, are perceived to be taking sides with one side or the other. people want journalists to take sides and perhaps don't even quite know how to respond if they are simply reporting fairly and in a balanced way.
Well, this has echoes of Iraq. It has echoes of Yugoslavia. But most chillingly, it has echoes of Rwanda. And in that case, the media was found in some ways to be culpable because radio stations, for example, were inciting violence via just the worst kind of hate speech. I understand that among Kenyan radio stations, there has been a similar pattern of hateful and even violent messages.
Yeah. Although I should say that, of course, what one saw in Rwanda, and many people who've seen the movie Hotel Rwanda will remember those brutal scenes when the airways were actually taken over. Whereas in this case, it's been much more subtle, has perhaps not been in any way policy, but it's still chilling. The United Nations Development Program did media monitoring in the run-up to the election and found that several vernacular stations were guilty of hate speech. Most of those stations have since tried to address this, but they do admit they are at a loss because of the subtlety of it. And because the broadcasts are in a vernacular language, you often find cultural, very subtle references that are perhaps more difficult to arrest. Sometimes it's an interviewee or perhaps somebody who calls into the station, because many of these programs are interactive, who says something either very inflammatory or often much more subtle. But of course, what it translates to is that the audience of this vernacular station hears this, and we know that the broadcaster must take responsibility for whatever goes on the air.
Have the media begun to figure out how to navigate the circumstances with the government and with the violence and do more of what you expect news organizations to do?
Yeah, well, you know, in late January, the Editors Guild said that it would take government to court, which did happen. And then we saw on the 30th of January, the organization I work for, Internews Network, organized a roundtable, and we wanted to encourage some kind of self-audit. We asked the question, what went wrong? It was just an overwhelming sense of admission of guilt, ranging from, you know, not keeping the hate speech in check, to not being robust enough about the ban, to not telling stories that coexist with the violence, in other words, stories of hope and reconciliation, to not framing this conflict within any kind of international context. So it was quite incredible the extent to which journalists admitted where they had gone wrong and are seeking to find new ways to address it.
All right, Ida, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Ida Yuste is the Kenya resident journalism advisor at Internews. There are no words to convey the sheer horror of realizing you've just hit send and dispatched an email to the wrong person. Horror is what a partner at the law firm Pepper Hamilton had to be feeling upon realizing that a confidential email about drug company client Eli Lilly had winged its way not to the intended recipient, but to a New York Times reporter named Alex Berenson. Berenson has written extensively about Eli Lilly's legal troubles surrounding the improper marketing of a drug called Zyprexa, and he's had disputes with the law firm Pepper Hamilton about his stories in the past. So, if you're Eli Lilly's legal representation, and you want to carefully plot out the public message around the fact that your client may be forced to pay $1 billion in fines, the largest ever for a drug company, you really don't want to email Alex Berenson. But here's what Berenson found one cold night in a remote town in Russia when he sat down to check his email.
I get a ton of spam in between the penis enlargement ads and the bet on the Super Bowl ads and the three or four emails that I know are actually real. I see this email that says, eager to catch up. It's a thread of five emails. And for some reason, I decided to open it, even though it wasn't anybody whose name I recognized immediately. It was just a series of first names. And it said, Tom and I were racing to other meetings when we left the EDPA, and I am just back. Looking for Tom so we can have a call. We'll call you as soon as I have him. preview. They're in the stratosphere on number, and Meehan wants a deal. And that was it. That was the whole email. Now, I think I just kind of looked at the screen and was like, wow. Boy, this was a mistake.
What was it about?
What it was about was Eli Lilly has been under civil and criminal investigation related to its marketing of Zyprexa. And so the EDPA, to translate this, is the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. They're in the stratosphere on number means that, you know, they were discussing some kind of settlement deal, and the Eastern District is coming up with a number that's a lot more than Eli Lilly and Pepper Hamilton thought was appropriate.
And Meehan, who wants to make a deal?
He's the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District. He's in charge of negotiating this.
So this was sent to someone named Berenson, but it was not meant for Alex Berenson.
Yes, it was meant for Brad Berenson, who is a lawyer at Sidley Austin, which is a a fancy law firm in Washington that is also representing Eli Lilly here because, you know, a big company never has just one law firm in a case like this. They usually have, you know, three or four or five. He is also a relative. He's a second cousin.
I'm going to take a wild guess and say you did not immediately reply to the lawyers at Pepper Hamilton to say, you know, you're going to laugh, but you sent this to Alex Berenson of the New York Times, who has been covering Eli Lilly and also your law firm's role in all sorts of mischief.
You are correct. I did not do that, and I also did not abide by the stock confidentiality notice that is at the bottom of all these emails that says, if you've reached this in error, delete this, or, you know, the Starfleet Enterprise will come get you. Those things have no legal standing, and so, you know, I just ignored them. I want to emphasize, I was aware before I got this email that these talks were going on. Sometimes you're aware of things as a reporter and you can't write about it because you don't have the sourcing locked down. And that's the position I was in.
How much time passed from the time you opened this thing on a cold Saturday somewhere on the outskirts of Siberia and when you filed your story with the Times? And were you in touch with the law firm about the email in the intervening time?
I got back to the United States Monday. I went into the Times Tuesday. I started to work on the story. And one of the places I naturally tried to call was the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And as soon as I called them, they, I think, felt honor-bound to call Pepper Hamilton and tell them this. And so I got a call from the person who'd sent this email to me saying, can you not use this? And I said, are you kidding me? Of course I'm going to use it. And
that makes me a little bit sad. Was this a partner at the law firm or just a lowly associate?
A very high-powered person who I don't think is used to asking for help. I think this person is more used to giving orders. So we had this conversation, and I said, look, this is real news. And then, you know, the person says to me, well, can you not use the fact that it was in this email, especially because you're obviously getting a lot of information from other places? And that seemed reasonable to me. I didn't see any need to shove Pepper Hamilton's nose in it. That was where we left it. And lo and behold, a couple days later, and I don't know where this came from, Portfolio Magazine called me and said, we heard that you got this email. And in the echo chamber of the retelling of the story, the email wasn't just a quick slip-up, but a really big blunder. That's not the truth, and that's one of the reasons I think I'm talking to you today, because I do want to set the record straight.
Okay, so at some point in the future, you're going to be at a wedding or a bar mitzvah or, Thanksgiving, and there will be Brad Berenson. And when you're next face-to-face, will you, in the interim, have discussed this?
I probably should drop him a note, and I probably should make sure I send it to him and not to somebody else by accident. But it will be funny the next time I see Brad, and I hope he has a sense of humor about it.
Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Alex Berenson is a reporter at the New York Times. His novel, The Ghost War, is being released this month by Putnam. Piracy is the greatest obstacle the film industry currently faces. Those were the words of Dan Glickman, chairman of the Motion Picture Association of America, before a House subcommittee hearing in 2006. Movie and record companies claim combined annual losses of more than $5 billion due to file sharing, pitting the entertainment industry against those who believe all content wants to be free. Wired magazine's Daniel Roth chronicled a recent battle in the piracy wars in the February issue of Portfolio, and the battle begins with Media Defender.
Media Defender is a company hired by the Hollywood studios and hired by almost all the record labels. And what they do is they go on to all kinds of sites on the internet where you can find free music, free movies, free games. You can download all this content, and they put up fake versions of all those movies, games, and songs. Like, there's a site called The Pirate Bay, which is the biggest site for finding free content. It's sort of a Google of piracy. And you go on there, you can find Die Harder, and you download it. And if Media Defender does their work correctly, you should spend 2 days downloading this movie, or a day and a half, depending on your internet connection. And it gets in, and you open it up, and it's all static. Media Defender has spoofed you. So Hollywood hires this company. They go out, they put these fake versions of the files all over the net, and the idea is to drive people who are trying to download crazy. They'll stop downloading them. They'll then go to Virgin Records and buy the movie, you know, legitimately.
And the media companies are feeling pretty secure with Media Defender. As far as they know, it's working.
Yeah, absolutely. They pay millions of dollars to have Media Defender try to protect their content online. And they see this as they're going to fight fire with fire. These pirates and these college kids are going to go online and use their high-speed connections. And they're going to download all of this stuff that the movie studios have worked so hard to create. And they're going to steal it from them as the way they see it. And they say, you know, we're going to battle back at you with technology. Now, the problem is, there are a lot more people and a lot more kids out there with a huge amount of technological background who have a vested interest in making sure that Hollywood's attempts to stop them don't actually work.
Okay, so arg, enter the Buccaneer Ethan, a high school kid who was bored during Christmas break. What did he do?
He's really more of a hacker than a pirate. He just tries to find weaknesses in different companies' firewalls. He happened to get into Media Defender, didn't know what the company was. Started poking around and discovered that this was a company that tried to put up fake versions of these files and try to defend the Hollywood studios. And for about 6 months, Ethan just sat there and watched the company. He could listen to their phone calls. He watched all of their email traffic. He got the entire Outlook database of the CEO. He knew how much people were paid. He knew all their social security numbers. And he just watched and waited. And in September, he took all of this email he had collected, and he published it on the exact same networks where you can download all these movies and games, places called BitTorrent networks. It was a huge file, and he said everyone can download these emails. They can learn how Media Defender works, and the pirates will now be able to defend themselves because all their tricks are revealed. And in fact, all their tricks were revealed.
When he posted all of the company's internal files, he invited other hackers, I guess, to go still deeper into that company. What's been the result of his hacking?
The result of his hacking is that Media Defender is in serious financial trouble. That company lost close to $1 million within a couple weeks of this happening. They have found that their defenses don't work as well as they used to. The pirates have been able to develop even smarter systems. So they've been able to look under the hood, see how Hollywood tries to operate against them and say, all right, well, we can now defend ourselves against this.
Where has it left the studios and the record companies? I mean, is the drawbridge down? Are the gates open? Or have they come up with other ways to keep pirates away?
You know, they are total believers in their ability to use their own billions and billions of dollars to fight this. They think they're going to win. If it's not going to be Media Defender, it'll be something else. The lawsuits are still going on against the college students. There are huge pushes going on in Washington right now to make it so that universities, if they don't stop file sharing on their campuses, then they won't receive federal funding. There are fights in each of the state legislatures to make sure that pirates don't have easy access to this content. They're going international. So there is absolutely no stopping the movie studios or record labels right now, despite showing little in the way of success for what they've been doing.
And what about Ethan? As we speak, he's probably sitting in Algebra 2 trig or something. Is he going to wind up, you know, working for Media Defender or for Sony or something?
I only pray that one day the federal government figures out a way to put him in their employ, make him work for the NSA or something, because he's definitely got some great tools. But I certainly don't ever see him going Hollywood.
Okay. Dan, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Daniel Roth, his report titled, "The Pirates Can't Be Stopped," is in the February issue of Portfolio.
One final note on the piracy wars. The website The Pirate Bay, the one Daniel Roth referred to as the Google of piracy, is run by four friends from Sweden, a country historically with lax intellectual property law. A little more than a week ago, however, Swedish authorities charged the four men with, quote, promoting other people's infringement of copyright laws. If convicted, they could face up to 2 years in jail. Whatever the outcome, it appears unlikely that the Pirate Bay can be shuttered, said one of the men last week. We don't know where the servers are. We gave them to people we trust. It could be three countries. It could be six countries. We don't want to know, he said, because you'll have a problem shutting them down.
Up next, pop cultural portrayals of Gitmo.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If there's a legal basis for this show, for the media we cover, and frankly, for the style of our coverage, it's the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. It's an ironclad protection for all manner of speech, popular and unpopular, a distinctly American bulwark against being silenced. Or is it? Anthony Lewis has been writing about the justice system in the press for over 40 years, and in his new book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, he argues that the First Amendment is actually poorly understood and for much of its history has been poorly protected by the courts. Part of the problem, he claims, is that the language of the amendment was left intentionally vague by the founders, and there's virtually no record of their deliberations over what or what not to include.
Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. But what does that mean? It's a very sweeping sounding statement, but it doesn't prevent laws against blackmail, which occurs by speech or press. It doesn't prevent laws against threats. It doesn't prevent laws providing copyright. So judges have to interpret it. The framers of the Constitution, the principal framer, James Madison and the others, deliberately wrote the Constitution in very open language because they knew that to last, it would have to be something much broader than a bill of particulars. If you had tried to list every imaginable kind of scenario, the mind couldn't have anticipated what was going to happen.
So the first decisive test for the First Amendment came a dozen years later with the passage of the Sedition Act. That was the big one, right?
Sedition Act was a statute that followed the old British idea of seditious libel, which is criminal punishment of those who criticize the government, the church, the president, the king. And in the United States, the Sedition Act specifically punished malicious criticism of the president. It didn't punish criticism of the vice president, who happened to be Jefferson, the leader of the opposite party. And the real purpose of the act, though it was said by the Federalists who passed it, to be necessary to stop French Jacobin terrorism from creeping into the United States, the real purpose was to shut up Jeffersonian editors before the election of 1800, when Jefferson would oppose Adams. And a lot of them were sent to jail.
And so do we see the pattern being set here? Is it always a question of national security that puts the blinkers on the First Amendment?
I don't know that it's always, but it certainly is predominantly so. And that's what Madison said. Fear of events abroad will reduce constitutional rights at home. He predicted that. And it's happened again and again in our history. During World War I, at the behest of President Wilson, Congress passed the Sedition Act, and people were jailed for the most innocuous comments, you know, President Wilson's a fool, he's running the war badly, things like that. And they were sent to jail for lengthy terms. In a great case, a group of radicals who threw anonymous pamphlets from the roof of a building in New York, criticizing Wilson for sending American troops to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution, were prosecuted under the 1918 Sedition Act and sent to prison for 20 years, 20 years for throwing a political pamphlet from the top of a building. It's incredible.
Then Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the decision that defended free speech.
Well, Holmes was an amazing man. The dissent that you're talking about, he wrote in 1919 in the case in which those people threw pamphlets from the top of a building in New York. And he said, memorably, we have to allow the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death.
And yet he flip-flopped, it seemed, on this issue. As you recount in your book, he had no problem with Eugene Debs, a famous union leader, being tossed in the clink.
Eugene Debs was 5 times a Socialist Party candidate for president. He made a speech in Dayton, Ohio, and he expressed sympathy for some men who were in prison nearby for counseling evasion of the draft. And Holmes just gave the back of his hand to Debs. And it's interesting, Debs ran for president the next time from a federal penitentiary. Friends of Holmes really never understood how he wrote that opinion, but in any case, rather quickly, within a few months, he changed his position and came out vigorously for freedom of speech and press.
It seems that these monumental challenges to the First Amendment happen at huge intervals. There was the case in the 1790s, then more than a century later in 1918.
In fact, no claimant for free speech or freedom of the press won a case in the Supreme Court from the beginning to 1931. It took 140 years for the Supreme Court to begin enforcing that amendment. Amazing.
And then you jump to 1964, New York Times versus Sullivan.
The case was about an ad that appeared in the New York Times, supported by backers of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., which said that Southern officials were racist and had abused civil rights demonstrators. And one of those officials sued for libel in Alabama, collected a huge sum from an all-white jury, and from a judge who so loved the Confederacy that he seated the jurors in his courtroom in Confederate military uniforms. And the Supreme Court overruled that huge libel verdict for the official of the city of Montgomery, Alabama, and really freed the press to cover Dr. King's movement. And, you know, Dr. King believed that if Americans generally knew the cruelties that were imposed on blacks in the South, they wouldn't like it. And it turned out when they saw people being brutalized on television or when they read about it in newspapers and magazines, they didn't like it.
Let's talk about the strange relationship between free speech and libel.
Libel was always considered to be outside the protection of the First Amendment. Libel had always been there, and people, even those who were for freedom of expression, thought libel was not protected. But then, in the case we've been discussing, New York Times against Sullivan, the formerly merely routine writ of libel was openly used by the official in Montgomery, Alabama, who sued the New York Times in the hope of suppressing the press to keep it from covering the civil rights movement in the South. So it became a political weapon, and the Supreme Court, when it considered the case, analogized it to the Sedition Act of 1798.
You come back again and again to how fragile free speech is, especially when fear is leveraged, the Sedition Acts, the Red Scare, Vietnam protests. Do you think the court learns from its mistakes, or do you see the same threats time and time again?
I see the same threat time and time again. These past episodes that you mentioned have had one salutary aftermath. That is, after each one, we apologized. We realized, we, the American people on the whole, or politicians, judges, realized that the reaction to the fear had been overdone. For example, in the case of the removal of Japanese Americans from the West Coast during World War II, eventually Congress passed an apology and a modest payment to the survivors. But where we are now, what's disturbing about the war on terror is that it's hard to see when that's going to end, when we can look back at it, because, you know, the terrorists are not going to come aboard the United States battleship Missouri, as the Japanese did at the end of World War II, and surrender. They're not going to do that, and it's going to trail on and on. The issue is now before the Supreme Court, not in a free speech case, but in a case testing the right of the president to hold alleged terrorists who have had no kind of process to determine whether they're in fact terrorists indefinitely in Guantanamo without any fair hearing or a chance to answer charges. Now, that case is really the test of the very thing you've questioned. What have we learned from the past?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Gladstone.
Anthony Lewis is the author of Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, A Biography of the First Amendment. In a 2004 film comedy, a couple of stoners named Harold and Kumar got a serious case of the munchies and head out for White Castle. In the sequel to the film, due out in April, the two friends, played by Asian American actors, go to Gitmo.
While on a plane, our fun-loving Indian-American hero, Kumar Patel, gets mistaken for a bomb-carrying terrorist in this post-9/11 era.
In reality, Guantanamo, or Gitmo as it's commonly known, is a prison complex on southeastern Cuba established by the American military on its naval base there shortly after the attacks of September 11th. In the nearly 6 years since it began receiving prisoners, Guantanamo has housed more than 700 suspected terrorists, or enemy combatants. We interviewed Miami Herald reporter Carol Rosenberg back in September, and she observed that Gitmo has become a recurrent pop cultural trope throughout the world, in memoirs and novels, in visual arts and theater, even song.
The stars for my blanket, I lie here on the ground, the sun's the only thing allowed to move around. I don't go in Guantanamo.
Rosenberg, who has visited the prison many dozens of times for hundreds of hours, believes that Gitmo has long since left the island of Cuba and taken on a symbolic life of its own. Certainly not what the U.S. had in mind back in 2002.
There always was the notion that it would become a Nuremberg, that it would become a place where America got justice, that they would create and hold these trials, and that we would learn that America had found and prosecuted the perpetrators of 9/11.
And now, of course, Guantanamo has become a kind of international stand-in for something much larger. When we shorthand Guantanamo today, what is it that we're actually talking about?
Indefinite detention without charge. The notion that the United States can take a person, put them on an extraterritorial piece of land, which they declare not to be the United States, and to say that as long as this war goes on, we can hold you without bringing you before formal charges, is what Gitmo, certainly in the left-wing circles, has come to mean. That's it. That's the shorthand. And it's 6 years later, and the debate is being played out. And I guess the point of my article is that it's being played out not in necessarily the arenas that you'd expect it to be, which would be at the Pentagon, in Congress, and at the courts, but in a way, the popular culture has hijacked the narrative.
So what was it in particular in pop culture that pushed you to do the story?
Poetry books and memoirs and kitsch and all these novels had been piling up on my desk for months. Then I see the Sicko trailer, Michael Moore's trailer for his documentary, shock documentary on the state of healthcare today.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses Guantanamo as a metaphor. Michael Moore is trying to get onto the base to show this fabulous free healthcare that the Pentagon has been boasting about. You know, part of the package tour at Guantanamo for first-time reporters is we give detainees the same free health care we give America's soldiers and service members. And so Michael Moore turns the narrative on its head and says, if it's good enough for Guantanamo, isn't it good enough for, I don't know, Georgia?
We commandeered a fishing boat and sailed into Guantanamo Bay.
These are 9/11 rescue workers. They just want some medical attention. The same kind that Al-Qaeda is getting. They don't want any more than you're giving the evildoers. Just the same.
As you say, Michael Moore took the government's talking points and turned them on their heads. Is that what most of the pop culture references do? Is depict Guantanamo as something quite different from what the military wants to describe it as?
Absolutely. It says, we don't agree with you, and we are going to answer through the arts. That's the thing about this Harold and Kumar story that's coming up that's so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They're portraying two men as having been caught up and misidentified as terrorists and landing at Guantanamo. I mean, it's a very interesting popular cultural response to the narrative that everybody down there is evil, everybody down there is guilty. Now you have this political satire where there's these two schmoes.
Fair enough.
They're not captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan, as the Pentagon alleges many of these people are. In this story that's coming, they end up down there, and I think the underlying message is they don't deserve to be there, and it's Kafkaesque.
Now, you open your piece with a one-man, one-hour play called Jesus, the Guantanamo Years, which was staged in Boston this summer. Tell me about that.
Well, this man who had done this show in Scotland and Ireland brought it to Boston. Jesus has come back to deliver a message in these troubled post-911 times and finds himself pulled out of the line at Kennedy Airport by immigration, where he's asked if he's willing to die for his ideals. And he's Jesus, so he says yes. And the next thing he knows, he finds himself at Guantanamo.
Let's be fair. This guy works for U.S. Immigration. So to him, I am a single male Palestinian of no fixed address, traveling alone with very little hand luggage. Not that reassuring, you'd have to say.
I see these things popping up all over, and I think we're all waiting maybe in the professional media, in the courts, in Congress, for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide. And popular culture, the things that are out there on the web that are bubbling from one end of the planet to the other, they're carrying on a parallel debate, and they're in a much different place than we are.
Now, the song we heard earlier in the intro was called Guantanamo by Stephen Coffey of the Harley String Band. There are a bunch of parody songs. Others that come to mind that are serious are by Patti Smith and Charlie Daniels, two very different artists with very different motivations. Here's a little bit of the Patti Smith. Now, Smith's song was inspired by the story of a former German-born detainee, and you've written that Germany has been especially fertile ground for Guantanamo as a reference point.
The man that Patti Smith sings about, Murat Kurnaz, is a Muslim son of Turkish immigrants, and he doesn't automatically get German citizenship. But he went back, he wrote his memoirs. They're in German. They were published. They're being translated. Germany, Australia, and London have been particularly fertile ground for some of this material.
Among other written bits of pop culture, a book of poems written by the prisoners themselves and published by a law professor, Mark Falkoff. What's the reaction been?
They had an initial 5,000 book run. The typical poetry anthology in America has a 2,500 book run, and they're in their second 5,000 book run. It's early, but it's possible that some fairly crudely translated poems from Urdu and Arabic by prison camp translators that made their way through the Pentagon's review system will be the most popular poetry anthology published in the United States this year.
Somebody who's been there many dozens of times, as we've said, when you look at some of the humorous, the satirical references to Gitmo, can you laugh?
I can't. I mean, it bothers me. I'm waiting for Congress to have a proper hearing to discuss these issues. I try to bring to the coverage a sort of gravitas. And into this vacuum is this slapstick humor. I mean, that's what it is.
Carol, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carol Rosenberg is the Guantanamo reporter for the Miami Herald.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider. We had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. WNYC is supported by DK Eyewitness Travel, publisher of guides to hundreds of destinations around the world, now available wherever books are sold. DK Eyewitness Travel, the guides that show you what others only tell you. Travel DK.com. This is NPR.